Imagine for just a minute a world that is safe, healthy, and green for everyone. For some of us, it's barely a stretch because for whatever reasons, we've been able to make choices or have the tools we need to create that kind of life for ourselves. And now, for just another minute, try to imagine that same world through the lens of someone who is homeless. It's very safe to say they are two different realities. You'll want to stay with me to hear from our two guests who are going to share with us an exciting cross-agency collaboration that is working diligently to provide safe, healthy, and green opportunities for our most vulnerable population and how it has been designed not just to create a sustainable world, but a resilient one in the face of climate change. Hey everyone, I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Down to Earth Tucson. And I think when I'm doing the intros to these shows, you can kind of catch my excitement. I thank you for listening, and I wonder if I'm ever not going to be excited about my guests or the content, because I'm really excited about this. But before I introduce our two guests, I want to give a shout out to a valued partner of Mrs. Green's World and the sponsor of this podcast, and that would be Habitat for Humanity Tucson. And they are all that. They really do believe that everyone deserves a decent place to call home. They also believe that no matter who we are or where we come from, all of us deserve to have a decent life, and they work to make that happen diligently. And those beliefs and values translate into action, into changing people's lives every single day, and to their leadership in making safe, healthy, green collaborations work. So now please join me in welcoming two people intimately involved with this exciting collaboration, Anne Vargas, who is the Community Development Director from Habitat for Humanity, and Joel Veers, Program Coordinator, Pima County Department of Community and Workforce Development. So welcome you two. We're finally making this happen, and it's great to have you here.
Thank you.
Hey, good afternoon, Gina. It's a pleasure.
They don't know how much fun we had getting ready for this, but maybe by the time it's over, they will. And I'm going to start with this. I mean, this podcast is what I call somewhat of a complex carbohydrate when it comes to being able to successfully communicate all the moving parts. And I want to get people really excited about what you're up to. And there are layers. There are many layers. There's like the dream and the vision layer, the structure of the program itself layer, and then the actual how do we make it all stick component to this. So let's get started. And, you know, I kind of did eeny, meeny, and Joel, you were eeny. So we'd like you to start off by setting the stage for us or setting the table or whatever you want to call it to give us some of the background on this collaboration, who's involved, how it came about. And that's why I call it a complex carbohydrate. There were lots of things that you all did with the Tucson Pima collaboration to end homeless to get us here to this podcast. So Joel, take it away.
Sure, thanks. I'd be happy to. And actually, this initiative, this collaborative, precedes my tenure at the county. So Anne may have to jump in as a longer timer on this and correct me on a couple of things here and there. In any case, this had its inception back in 2012. I don't know who initiated it, but it was designed as a collaborative between the city of Tucson and Pima County. And I think early on we identified Habitat as a good conduit to actually bring this to the agencies and help manage it and make it something live. And since ourselves as government, we're good at giving money and not necessarily following through on it. In any case, with this initiative, we contracted, or rather Habitat contracted with a architectural firm to go out and do some assessments in transitional and emergency housing facilities here in the county and find out kind of, basically it's a snapshot, it's a baseline of the conditions in the facilities as regards safety, health, and kind of efficiency is what we mean by green. Sort of a baseline for those conditions and the functionality of the shelters. So it was a pretty involved process. Each agency got a comprehensive report. And by going through this assessment presentation to them, they were then eligible for competitive funding. Initially, the county put up about $100,000 committed per year, and the city put up about $150,000. I'm happy to say that this year, while the county hasn't stepped up a little further yet, the city has put in another $100,000, so we're up to $300,000 total per year for this project or this initiative. The broad goal is to just improve the facilities by making them safer, healthier, and more efficient to operate and maintain, so that the shelters can actually do a better, more efficient, and less stressful, you know, delivery of their services and help the people, that the vulnerable populations that really need it. So we've spent to date almost $750,000 on this. And last year, it's just kind of a quick snapshot of what we've been doing. In 2019, we revisited the assessment with the same firm and tackled again. It's probably, let's see, we vary between 13 and 11 agencies that have participated any one time or another, and anywhere from, because they manage or own multiple facilities, anywhere from 24 to 30 different units that we, you know, can assess individually for their needs. It really has been a great experience to just interface with these agencies, find out what their needs really are, and, you know, explore into the future, which is what Anne is going to talk about a little bit more.
And there's so much of this, when you talk about it, that is the cross-collaboration. And I've seen it in so many situations where people have a common goal and an intention and learn from each other. So there's a lot of feeding the vision and the excitement around it, because, well, I did this on my facility. Well, you should try that. Or I did this and it didn't work. So that, I love that part of any successful collaboration. So, Anne, when I've had conversations with you about this going back months ago, when you first, you know, touched base with me, you really eloquently shared what I call the vision for the project. There's excitement and passion in your voice. So what do you think is the big vision for this, and why does it excite you? It's not just about putting in air filtration systems and solar on the roof. There's a much, to me, higher level vision that is coming out of it, or has the potential to come out as a result of this effort.
Right. Gina, first I'd like to, if I could, give a shout out to the 11 organizations so that people understand the variety
totally
of homeless shelters that are involved in the collaboration. We have CODAC, Emerge Center Against Domestic Abuse, O Pueblo Community Services, Catholic Community Services, Pio Decimo, Tucson Metropolitan Ministries, Our Family Services, Primavera, Esperanza and Escalante, Salvation Army, Sister Jose's Women's Shelter, and Southern Arizona AIDS Foundation. And as you can imagine, these organizations are on the front line right now with COVID-19, assisting our homeless population, which has really offered us an opportunity to examine resilience in terms of the Safe, Healthy, Green collaboration. So the way we're looking at it, and why we have engaged Mrs. Green in going forward and supporting the organizations, is that we're really trying to operationalize our values and go beyond looking at what we can do with the facilities and plan into the future for what might be a cost avoidance. So right now, the homeless organizations are very concentrated on addressing emergencies related to COVID, but because we have this updated report from Poster Murto McDonald that has evaluated the facilities for energy retrofits, major systems, and perhaps even landscaping, we can take that plan as a tool and talk about making improvements with the funds that are set aside by the city and county, and also operations, maintenance plans, and peer-to-peer support for kind of like best practices, what works. So really the vision is, in terms of cost avoidance, is okay, we have a budget, we run a shelter, but let's look at, are we doing things in a way that's going to deliver our values to our individual shelters, in the people living in our shelters and the people who operate the shelters, as well as the surrounding community?
Okay, I don't know if I have this question right when I hear that response, because on the one hand, there is the very technical, very concrete, very measurable components to what you can do to make a facility more resilient. But before we get into some of those specifics, and we may not even have to, because it's more about what the coalition is going to do to move us all forward, there's the human factor in this that I believe is the impetus behind Safe, Healthy, and Green. Mm-hmm. And these are really, really vulnerable people who most of us don't know much about, let's be honest, let alone the challenges they face every day, like not having an address, maybe not having a phone number, a place to go to the bathroom, a place to clean up every day. My friend had a daughter who was homeless, and the things that she talked to me about and kind of her daughter's reluctance to even go to a shelter. So what are some of the considerations that I hope I'm right had to be factored into when it comes to a program design and implementation, like the human factor? It's really not just about a thermostat. So is that a trick the guest question, you guys, or do you want to respond to it?
Well, no, I mean, that's absolutely right. And you know, the impetus of this initiative so far, at least from my level and not being on the ground, is simply getting the retrofits there, getting the issues addressed. Unfortunately, you know, right now, yes, there are a lot of vulnerable people right now, increasingly vulnerable, and more of them because of the pandemic. And that's kind of put the shelters into an emergency mode. So they are dealing principally with direct on the ground hard fixes.
It's like triage, Joel. Mm-hmm. I don't mean to interrupt, but I thought, can you imagine?
Oh, that's exactly what it is. And what we're hoping is as we can learn to develop and hopefully come out the other end of this, that we will have some more long-term and comprehensive and kind of deeper solutions.
So I love that answer. Anne, do you want to add anything to that?
Well, I can add a recent conversation we had right before the shutdown, where the shelter staff and the collaboration had convened around, how do we transport somebody to the hospital? How do we sequester them? How do we store medications? I mean, all of those very basic human things that everybody's going through. Individuals who are homeless have to look at shelter as home, and it gets very complicated for them, and it does prescribe changes to the space, flexibility, and meeting each individual where they are in terms of assisting them in moving to a more stable environment.
So that's a big piece of it. And I can't imagine when we were talking, and so everybody knows, Anne and Joel and I had these like conversations with Maury, where we just kept going on, and what about this? And what about that? And we should talk about this. But it's very real and very, I don't know how, it's like the crux of it to me is that you're dealing with probably, I think, one of our most vulnerable populations, if not the most. I can't think of anything worse than homelessness, except maybe living in an abusive situation. But it's really the facility being prepared, but how do you do what you just said? Make it a home for the homeless. I mean, that's what you're trying to do. And it's a perfect segue to, you know, in my world, doing this for the past almost 13 years, the conversation around in the climate change space has changed dramatically. Pretty much nobody talks about sustainability anymore. It was a gradual shift, and then all of a sudden it's bam, because we used to talk about sustainability. Well, now we are in triage mode as a planet, whether people want to believe that or not. So locally and nationally and globally, it's shifted dramatically from talking about sustainability to resiliency, which means climate change is here, and how do we become more resilient? So I'd love to hear both of you, what your thoughts are about that. And then how do you weave that into the conversation about all you're doing, into that initiative? So that's a long two-part question. Take your time.
That could be a long two-part answer, but right. Go ahead. Or a three-part answer.
I can say this is resiliency is kind of on different scales. And I think you touched on this, Gina, in terms of the human scale. But, you know, for a long time, we've been talking about in every program we do, and in particular programs partnering with homeless people, helping them find stability, is to empower the individual. So if you're the case manager and you're meeting that person where they are right now and looking at how you can empower them, whether it's with knowledge or connecting them to the appropriate services, there's a resiliency factor in there. There's an efficiency factor in the way services are delivered, and that could be the way you staff your program, the way you design it, so that somebody is not having to reach, you know, four different agencies or take public transit all over town to try to fill very basic needs. Assessing location factors is resiliency. Building systems is resiliency. There's a fabulous network of nonprofit agencies working on homelessness in Tucson, and the way they communicate with each other is resiliency. And then the Safe, Healthy, Green is the piece of the puzzle that is about innovation and technology at the site in the immediate environment, where you have shelter operators very concentrated on delivering services, but they need a little room to plan ahead for kind of a larger vision of how their campus or their shelter will provide those services and can operate meeting the outcomes with less cost and higher quality. It's a big, big question, but it's amazing when you sit down and talk to 11 organizations and the people who are in the trenches, all of the great ideas they have, from managing the donations to ways to organize your maintenance schedules or your replacement of major systems.
If I can jump back just a second without losing that place, is I think early on, Gina, you mentioned you know, the chance for peer exchange, and we get these shelters together. Say we get 12 representatives together in a room. They may not have met each other, and now they have a chance to share their challenges and opportunities. And I think particularly in this day and age, resiliency to me implies the flexibility and the ability to engage with others, to share resources, information, whatever it is. And that's, you know, yes, we want to address the direct equipment replacement, but we would like this to foster a broader conversation among, think of it as an association of shelters, where they can exchange resources, you know, if somebody has something that somebody needs and they don't need it at this time, or information, or just best practices. Workshops in maintenance, mentoring, things like this, above and beyond the hard, you know, activities and the roof replacements.
Right. The human factor. And to me, that's a lot of what both of you have talked about in our conversations. And it excites me because there's a better chance of success and what I call systemic change. So, Anne, you have another mindset that I really like and I'd like to bring up, especially when you're working with a population like the homeless, and changing the conversation in all of this from that of deprivation and lack and these poor people and what they don't have. And how do we shift that deprivation mindset, or what I call deficits-based, to one of hope and change and value added? Because I got news for you. Those people on the streets, they are resilient. They are survivors. They are facing things that I haven't even had to have a nightmare about, right?
Right.
So talk about why it's so important to have that mindset of hope and change and not lack and deprivation. Why do you think that's important?
Well, I think the foundation of safety is, a basic human need. And that's part of what this is. I mean, shelters are constructed so that people have a place to go to get out of the elements and have somebody who cares. In terms of deprivation, I mean, I agree with you, Gina. I think homeless people are some of the most resourceful people we have in our community. And we have a very giving community as well. I mean, I got pictures of the hand washing stations that were put up all over town. Something as simple as that. As soon as there was a need, and those hand washing stations were strategically placed for the homeless population. So I do think, using innovation, it's not a big mysterious thing. And I think that's part of what the message is. It's realizing the potential. And if an individual can be empowered to solve issues that they're facing and they feel safe in a shelter to come forward or even be part of, let's say, redoing the landscaping and learning skills that they can take forward into stability, it's a much, as you say, more hopeful future. I think I talked a little bit about cost savings versus cost avoidance. And reading up on that concept, it really resonated with me. I mean, we all adopt budgets, boards of directors of nonprofits adopt budgets and talk to CEOs who have to make decisions about priorities. And we all deal with a baseline that's very, for homeless populations, can involve a lot of restrictions and government funding that makes it feel like, you're doing so much paperwork and you're not realizing that human aspect of the program. But if you look at cost avoidance and long-term, whether it's putting insulation into the shelter so that you don't have to turn on the heat or the cooling as much, that's a solution for cost avoidance. Helping somebody get educated, giving them a holistic approach so that they don't cycle back into homelessness, that's a cost avoidance in terms of what we all pay in terms of homelessness in Tucson and Pima County.
You mentioned clients perhaps assisting with landscaping and things like that, activities like that. That's truly an investment in human capital, which mm-hmm. we know how important that is, particularly with somebody who's faced with the challenges that these clients are. I know that some of the shelters, before things kind of got a little crazy, had been working on vegetable gardens, things like that, that the clients could actually, would get some satisfaction, would get some meditative practice out of, and some results. And I think that's really important, things like that. So hopefully we can...
That's a perfect example.
Do things like that.
Mm-hmm. Even in prisons.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Even in prisons, it brings about transformation like you wouldn't believe. So it's great. I'm glad that we all agreed this was going to be a very robust conversation, so that if I interrupt you, I'm sorry. I'm so excited about what you're doing, and I'm usually very good at sitting here quietly like a little observer, but I'm part of this, and Mrs. Green's World is going to be a part of one of the tiers of this, which makes me excited. So Joel, let's swing over to you for a minute. You touched on it briefly, but just go a little bit more into, COVID hit all of us up the side of the head. And so many people I talk to now are like, here we go, round two or three or whatever. And it doesn't impact my life greatly, let's be honest, because one of the most important things is to be able to wash your hands and have hand sanitizers and wear a mask. And I can afford all those things. So how has COVID hit this collaboration up the side of the head? Because if I'm running a shelter and you're going to talk to me about a training curriculum, I'm going to like, dude, are you serious? I'm doing triage and putting out fires. So how do you, how have you, some of the partners, how have you handled the triage, or what's the situation currently?
Yeah, you're exactly right. And it's affected them in two principal ways, kind of broadly. One is, as you've said, and is completely true, they're in triage mode. They're just trying to deal with increased numbers, increased needs. Fortunately, we did get some other funding that we were able to get out. So in terms of PPE, things like that, hand sanitizers, I think they're more or less doing okay right now. But the other issue is that the need for social distancing has mean that at the same time that they have increased demand, their capacity has gone down. We do have some funding out for some retrofits, but again, this is somewhat temporary. We're changing open space into, which would be common space, which is important for people. We're changing it into bunking space, essentially. That's not a good situation, and I don't know when that'll go away. We've had one shelter that has had to essentially shut down part of their operations. So at the same time, they're facing staff issues. You know, some of their staff may be sick. Some of their staff may have to distance or work from home. So it's kind of a perfect storm in a way.
You know, it really is. And Ann and I were talking about, I, of course, with many of my fellow Tucsonans, was doing the happy dance the other day when my thermostat actually went below 70 degrees. And then when I got up in the morning, it was below 40 degrees. And because of this show, I'm a lot about gratitude. If I'm in a bad mood, I say, okay, stop, take a deep breath, and run your gratitude list through your head. Homeless people were probably not doing the happy dance. It was freezing. So even that, when the shelters are full and they have to do social distancing, it's like a big, jumbled, painful thing for me to think about in my head. And let's not go off on that tangent, what's in my head, because we'll be really sorry. But let's talk about the third component of this. And there's a lot of pieces to this that I want to kind of circle back to, because when the time is right, we're very excited on the Mrs. Green's World team about what I call the third part of this complex carbohydrate, and that's making things stick, incorporating capacity building and training and ongoing support for non-shelter organizations. Because to me, resilience is not something you do. It's a mindset. It's a way of showing up in the world. It becomes a part of the culture, and things become almost, you know, second nature. And of course, I'd bring it up that I'm excited because Mrs. Green's World is going to be part of the implementation component. What are your thoughts in terms of the excitement about that? Why do you think that's a critical component to this in the future, in the after times, as I call it, when it can really, you know, things may calm down, the curve may really flatten a little bit, and we can give all of these people that are so taxed in their jobs, to me, it's like giving them something, giving them some tools and some, you know, pathways to this.
Yeah, I'll certainly let Ann carry this forward. Before this all hit, I think we had a big basket full of really great ideas on how to address a lot of these issues and a lot of this capacity building. And I think they kind of got put to the wayside. Now, as kind of the facilitating and management and convening entity, Habitat and Ann specifically will be kind of charged with the creativity and coming up with these ideas and carrying them forward with our support. So I'll let her answer that then.
I think that, again, we've learned sort of trial by fire how resourceful we are when faced with a pandemic and with our most vulnerable population. So I think the timing is really appropriate to help people who are running the shelters sit down and really rethink the strategy. So we'll have three workshops with Mrs. Green, starting with how do we go from cost savings and sustainability into resiliency? Like, what is your vision for how your shelter runs? One of the words that we've been using is convening the change makers.
Love it.
And that's not something you typically say to to shelter operators. It's like, we want you to bring all your change makers to the table and envision, you know, without all these restrictions, without the emergencies necessarily, but just set aside some time to think about, how would you run this campus? How would you run this facility? How would you serve individuals and partner with them in a way that is like the highest and best use and honors the potential of every single person? And I know that sounds very lofty, but we don't always allow that conversation to take place. And then backing into it, as you say, Gina, it's a practice. You know, it's something that you practice, and whether it's, you know, a change in behavior or the way you purchase things or the way you hire or create your organizational structure. That's what we hope to unpack during our workshops with you. And I'm a strong believer that you can be creative and you can meet all of the restrictions that come with your funding or your operations. And I don't think, you know, we should cut ourselves off from that opportunity. So we're going to welcome you to have those workshops in the spring of 2021.
You know, even with Scale Up, which is a demonstration project that was created by Local First, that we're doing actually four total cohorts where businesses participate for a six-week class, it's been unbelievable. And part of that is my part is creating a culture of sustainability. Shocking, I know. But what in developing it, Mike Peel and I talked about, it's one thing to train people and give them tools. It's another thing to coach and support them over time. And to me, that's what the kind of the essence of this is. We're going to give you tools, but we're going to be available. We're going to provide you with resources because it's not just, you know, turn the light switch off. It is that mindset and it becomes part of the culture. So I agree with you, Anne. It has to be somehow, it gets woven into the culture of sustainability. So I have a really annoying question for both of you. One of my hot buttons is when I'm at a conference or on a call or something, and someone throws this out. Well, if you can't measure it, it didn't happen. And I don't believe that at all, because I think a lot of the things that happen in cases like this are the relationships that you're talking about, the seed you might have planted with a homeless person that says, now really what I want is to have my own garden someday. You cannot measure all that. And yet, this is government funding. So, I mean, there are metrics that are important. I don't want to, you know, poo-poo that, so to speak, in that very highly sophisticated language. But kilowatts of energy saved, if you're me, very important. Very important. You know, cost savings on transportation, less CO2 emissions, all of those things really matter. But what, for the both of you, what's success going to look like for you? What are the kinds of things that you're hoping about? Because I see one already. The collaboration is already in place. That's a success. I don't know how you measure that on a scale, but what do each of you, in your mind, what are you going to feel good about in terms of measuring success or impact? And Anne, why don't we start with you?
I'm going to go back to Gina, operationalizing values. So of those 11 organizations I mentioned, I went on each of their websites and I looked at their mission and I looked at their values. I looked at their objectives and their programs. And there were some common denominators when you talk about a collaboration. And that was, you know, one of the things I was analyzing, like, let's look where these organizations are already connected. They had words like diversity and acceptance and respect and choice, creativity, commitment, accountability, growth.
Wow.
Brave. Somebody had brave.
Wow.
And connection. So if we're going to talk about, you know, these are our values, I would love to have a conversation about how we operationalize those and then measure them. It might be just that we're setting a baseline for progress in terms of solutions. And as you said, you know, there are metrics and those are important. But if what we do is get limited by the metrics or the restrictions that somebody else is putting on our organization, and we're sacrificing diversity, acceptance, respect, integrity, bravery, connection, that's the conversation. So my big hope for this is that we can do the practical side, and with that comes the values and the mission for each of these agencies.
You know, I get to say this once in a while. I love it when I ask a guest a question, they say, oh, Gina, that's a great question. Well, Anne, that was a great answer. It was a really great answer. And it's because those things are measurable. It's more of a nuance sometimes, a change in mindset. But you obviously do your homework when it comes to these things because we've had many conversations. So I love that answer. And no pressure, Joel. Do you want to add to that?
Well, I'm not sure I can live up to that, but sure. I think it depends, of course, on how you define metrics. But first, on a practical level, I think if, from the county's point of view and the city, because the city is kind of allowed us to manage this, from the practical standpoint, we have not imposed any metrics on any of these funding streams. For instance, we have a metric for Habitat. We have to have a certain number of kind of you know, community events or collaborative events. But the agencies themselves, there's no metric for them. We'd like to see them increase their efficiency, and we have asked them about the utility bills and things like that. But there's no requirement. So that part of it's one thing that we've been able to be flexible about. The other thing is, in terms of metrics, to me, one way to look at it is, well, we're starting at point A. When we get to point B, no matter how you got there, what the metrics are in between, I can show you progress because I can show you a building that's safer, healthier, and greener, you know, regardless of how we got there. That's kind of my broad metric on that one.
See, I think that's a great answer because I learned something that I didn't know. The fact that the city and the county are putting this opportunity out there, and it's not all about the metrics, but it's a different kind of substantive change because what they're allowing you to do will make a difference. So this is a perfect segue to the next question. You guys are good in setting me up so perfectly. If we're sitting here a year from now, which I would love to be able to do that, and considering maybe a COVID year, hopefully just maybe a regular year, like in 12 months, what used to be a year, what would, you know, my favorite expression these days is, what would spark absolute joy in both of you when talking about this collaborative and why it was beyond successful? What did that conversation look like or feel like for you? Because I always think it's great to have that. This would make me so happy if I could have that. Do you have an answer for that, or is that not fair?
My first answer would be, I would love for the agencies to come to us and say, hey, can we have another workshop? Mm-hmm. Or something like that.
Love it. And invite Mrs. Green. See, that would spark joy in me.
Sure. And the fact is, I mean, back to metrics too, is that you know, as a county program coordinator, I don't know anything about shelters. I learned so much from talking with these people and talking with a group of them that are sharing their own experiences. You know, that's a metric.
Got it. And Anne, what would spark joy in you? And you know that I use that, Anne, because the thing that sparks the most joy in me, as everybody in my world knows, is my granddaughter, Rooney. But other things spark joy in my heart also. So what would spark joy in you, Anne?
Well, I can relate to that. Jackson is a big joy in my life, and so is Emily.
I know. And Lord knows we need joy.
Yes, joy. So let's make a more resilient future for these grandchildren.
Oh, great answer.
Yeah, I mean, what would make me feel really good full of joy regarding this is for the 11 organizations to feel and say they got something out of resiliency planning in the workshops, and that they have a tool in hand that will allow them to go after resources that they hadn't considered, to have conversations with their donors that they hadn't considered, to implement more empowerment for the people who seek shelter from them. That would make me the happiest. To take some of the limits away so that we can free up their creativity.
Okay, that's great.
Amen.
Love it, love it. Have to think about that. Okay, so this is the part. I mean, we are going on and on. And I think we covered a lot of great territory, and there's the whole ADD factor that sometimes listeners can get with a podcast. I think we kept it pretty entertaining and engaging. So let me ask you this. Is there anything that you're both sitting there thinking, I hope Gina asked me this, I hope she asked me this, and I didn't? Because I'd like to be able to put that out there if there's something that you think is critical to include in this conversation.
I was just thinking one thing that's really important to me, certainly, is that, you know, we're in the middle of this unprecedented event, and I have to, in my personal life and my work life, think of this as one of the most enormous learning experiences. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a challenge that we have to learn to deal with, and things will be different. And for me to think of it as anything else will start making me crazy. You know, you can't think of, oh my God, things are so bad.
Right.
This is, we're learning to kind of ride two bikes at once.
That is a great, I don't know if you call it a metaphor or analogy, but Joel, you're right. You're really right. So Anne, what about you? Is there anything that you wish I had jotted down or that you want to add?
Well, I always think about, you know, this giving community that we live in. And the only thing I would add, and something that I've learned from the shelter providers, is it's really important to ask them what they need if we're all going to get on board with resiliency, because they know, and it's really helpful if we all are kind of aligned, given, as Joel says, we're riding two bicycles. So at any point in time, you know, my observation is they have been amazing at rising to the occasion, but as a giving community, ask them what they need, and that's how we can all get them on the path to resiliency.
It's important we learn from them, of course. We're all in this together.
You know, you guys, no wonder I get excited about this. Seriously, it's just, you know, our tagline for a long time was, we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And it's the same mindset. Mm-hmm. Tell us what you want. And when I ran my social service agency, it was like, what are your strengths and how can we help build on them? Not, can you please tell me what all your problems are and we'll try to solve them? Because that's that deprivation mindset versus strength building or capacity building. So, well, I guess, you know, I usually wrap it up and I have last words that I hope never sound like I'm pontificating and are just much more about reflection about my experience in this. And this time it may sound kind of weird, but I'm weird, so that's good. Developing the content for this podcast and for the training we're going to be doing, it really made me spend some time in a place of gratitude and reflection. And as I mentioned, and we talked about a little bit, when it got cold here, I went and turned the heat on and put on warm clothes, and everybody was happy. And we're like, oh my gosh, it's so cold. We're so happy. And because of this podcast, I stopped and thought about the place of gratitude that I was coming from versus people that were homeless and that might have a cardboard box to keep them warm if they're lucky, who didn't have any warm clothes to change into. It's like, oh great, it's sweater weather. Well, for homeless people, it's whatever wardrobe you have in the little bag that you might be lucky enough to carry. And the nightmares and the challenges of what they have to face on a regular basis are honestly beyond what I can imagine. But I think having the consciousness and the respect and the emotions I had around that are something that has been really good for me. And then I guess the other part is what really excites me about being engaged with this effort is that it will make me think more consciously about homeless people and the impact of homelessness on our community and how, as you said, Anne, in one of our conversations, the goal is to end homelessness. So that would be a wonderful dream down the road. And my part, how I can hopefully in some small way help make a difference for these vital members of our community. They matter. They're human beings, and I will look through a different lens. And of course, my final words are always for you, the listener, because without you, there would be no us. So Joel and Anne, thank you for all of the great conversations we've had, for being enthusiastic, for including Mrs. Green's World in this vision and dream. And I can't wait. And I hope we can do some more podcasts telling the story of what actually happened. So thanks to both of you so much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.